Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to all the men and women who have served and are currently serving in the United States Air Force throughout the world.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
Yes, here we are once again for another Veterans Radio program right here on our flagship station, WDEO, right here in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan, the Garden Spot of the Midwest. And they're also part of the Ave Maria Network. Today we've got a program. Well, you know, we like to do programs not just of the past, but of the future. And I have a guest that is absolutely dynamite, Dr. Rebecca Grant. She's been on the program before. She's a spokesperson with the Air Force, and she will be our guest today and talking about defense strategy, Air Force defense strategy into the next decade. And with me operating the board is our board person, Nina. How you doing, Nina?
Good morning, Bob. How are you today?
Oh, you're going to say hello to your mom and dad?
Hi, mom and dad. I love you.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Yes, we do a lot of that. And she's got a big smile on her face, mom and dad. Okay. Well, we've got Dr. Grant coming on the program in just a few minutes here. We've got, what do we have, Nina? She's signaling me. Oh, we have our first break. Good. We'll be back with defense strategies into the next decade with Dr. Rebecca Grant right after this message. Oh, yeah. Nielsen Schmielsen. That was the album. That one's from Jump Into the Fire. We may be jumping to the fire. There's going to be a whole lot of changes. A whole lot of changes with our defense budget in the next decade. And we have on the, well, you know, first of all, I think I'm going to give you just a little bit of background very quickly. Back in the beginning of January, President Obama announced his new defense strategy. This is all, I believe, part of cost shifting, etc. And it shifts the U.S. from a decade of war in Iraq and Afghanistan to where we're going to be changing our whole strategy as to whom we're going to be targeting. Ooh, maybe that's a bad pun. But we're going to be looking at terrorists. And then to quote President Obama, get rid of outdated Cold War era systems. Okay. Well, he was talking about it's clear that some prominent remaining Cold Air War systems will live on, and that includes the B-52 bomber and the U-2 spy plane. Wow, it's all part of a foundation of U.S. nuclear deterrent strategy. On the line with me right now is Dr. Rebecca Grant, who is president of IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Independent Research, a public policy research organization in Washington, D.C. Dr. Grant is an active member of the Air Force Association. She writes regularly for Air Force Magazine and served from 2008 to 2011 as the founding director of the Mitchell Institute. Dr. Grant, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Bob. It's nice to be on this morning.
Well, it's nice to have you. Well, let's talk about those Cold War era systems, namely the B-52, who, how many times have they had the requiem for that wonderful war bird, and it's lived on and lived on for 60 years. I know recently you had the occasion to fly in one. Why don't you tell us about that?
Oh, I'm so glad I can start there. I was the guest of our Air Forces out on Guam, which is out in Micronesia. It's, you know, Guam is 8 hours flight away from Hawaii. So it really is the piece of sovereign U.S. soil, the furthest out in the Pacific. We've had bombers stationed on Guam on a rotational basis for about the last 8 years. I visited there during a big exercise with Air Forces from Japan and Australia. And my hosts were the 23rd Bomb Squadron from Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. They were so kind as to let me fly in what they call the instructor pilot seat, which is right behind the pilot and the co-pilot, in a B-52. And I got to make a flight and see how they do their mission. It was just one of the most exciting days of my life.
What did it sound like inside the bird?
The power, you just can't imagine. The B-52 has 8 engines on the wing, and the power when they start those things up is incredible. You have to wear earplugs just to walk out to the airplane. You have to wear earplugs in the airplane underneath your flight helmet. So it sounds like all the power of the human race combined into one sleek, dark gray aircraft.
Could you see the ground from where you were sitting? I heard that the pilots can't really see the ground, that they have to look straight out. Is that true?
Well, certainly they can see the runway, and I was a little bit back of them but had a really good view. And that runway on Guam is so historic. It's built partly of coral, and it has a shiny white glow to it. It also has a little rise at the end of the runway, and at the end is a cliff that goes right down into the Pacific Ocean. So you go down the end of this super, super long runway and lift up, and suddenly there below you are the waves crashing as you are peeling off into the sky. But the power of the B-52 is pretty immense, and we lifted off. It seemed like, just as they say, like a homesick angel, the B-52 lifted off. So it was pretty neat to feel that.
And your heart was pounding.
It certainly was.
Next time, please take along somebody from Veterans Radio. I volunteer. They told me never to do that in the Army. I volunteer. Absolutely. Now, when we're talking about Cold War era systems, the B-52, what is the future for the B-52?
Well, there is a long future ahead for the B-52. It just seems amazing, Bob, because this is an aircraft that was designed in the early 1950s. Hundreds of them were built. We now have just over 70 left in the active flying force. There are 4 squadrons. 2 are based up at Minot in North Dakota, including the one I flew with, and there are 2 others down at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. But these aircraft have a very important double mission. They contribute to nuclear deterrence, and they also perform conventional missions, which is, of course, what they were doing out on Guam. So they're part of all the war plans for the Pacific Theater. That means these crews have to be very proficient in the exacting standards of flying with nuclear weapons and training to use them if necessary, and also with training to use conventional weapons, particularly whether that would be gravity bombs or conventional air-launched cruise missiles. And the fact is, we plan to keep these bombers flying for another couple decades.
Well, some think that the U.S. should do away with the bomber's role as part of the triad, land, sea, and air, because, well, we're not having that same, I guess you'd say, the enemy, or that same strategy. We really have terrorists. I don't think the B-52 is going to work well for terrorists, or will it? What do you say about that?
Well, really good question, Bob. Actually, the B-52 has done quite a bit of work, not in recent years, but early on in Afghanistan. Just a little 10 years ago, there were B-52s based out of Diego Garcia, and they were flying conventional missions, dropping bombs in Afghanistan on terrorists while U.S. Army and Marine and coalition forces were fighting on the ground. They did that again in Iraq in 2003, and now the B-1 bomber performs that mission daily. But we're talking about the B-52, and it has a role still in these conventional operations, but its nuclear deterrence role is still very important. There have been some significant changes in our nuclear posture as a result of the agreements between Obama and Medvedev back in a couple years ago. And so we see reductions going on. There were some cuts made to the B-52 fleet. But it remains an important part of the triad. And, Bob, the thing that people really stress about the bomber, in this case it's the B-52 and the B-2 stealth bomber in the triad, is that it's a very flexible weapon. You can forward base a B-52 on Guam, for example, and send a message to the region. And it's a two-sided message. One, it shows that American power is there, and that points to countries perhaps like China, who are improving their military capabilities and says, hey, we're only going to let you go so far. But the other half of the message goes to our allies and partners in the region, and it says that American military presence is here, and we'll stand with our allies when it really counts.
So when we hear that the Obama administration, to cut costs, is going to be cutting back on the number of nuclear weapons because there's going to be a cutback in the role of the bomber, that's pretty accurate, and it's not really, should I say this, going to be a detriment to our capability for preventive of a nuclear war, correct?
That's right. The desire has been, and the treaty now is an agreement to come down to some lower numbers, and I think that's probably a healthy thing. But we want to be sure to maintain that triad, and that's the administration's policy right now. We do hear a lot of discussion about whether the submarine force or the intercontinental ballistic missiles, the land-based ICBMs down in their silos, or whether the bombers should be reduced. But most of the professionals in the business, and particularly the commanders of strategic command who are responsible for carrying out that mission, they want to keep the triad because each part of it brings some significant advantages. And the nuclear deterrence is stronger with each of its three legs rather than going down to just two.
Well, here is another aircraft, a favorite of mine. And that is the A-10 Warthog. That this thing was scheduled to the scrap heap many times. It's been reconstituted, reincarnated. It's still a stick and rudder. It's not run by computers, folks. I mean, the guys have got to sit in. Guys and gals, oh, Lord, I got to make sure I get that right. And they can sit in, the pilots, there we are, in the cockpit, and fly the darn thing, get low to the ground. It's very effective against the Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, et cetera, et cetera. What is the role for the Warthog, the A-10?
You're right. We're going to keep the A-10, and pilots really do love it. I'm sure glad you said the men and women who fly the A-10, because one of the most famous incidents with the A-10 occurred back in 2003 when a young woman captain pilot brought her A-10 back with significant battle damage back to a base in Iraq. And she had lost some of the hydraulic systems that control the aircraft, and she had to manually fly that aircraft in using a lot of muscle power, and she did it. Did a real good job. That's one thing the pilots love about the A-10 is its rugged durability. We've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan much more use of strafing, just like you remember from the World War II movies. We've had all sorts of aircraft down at low level strafing against Al-Qaeda and Taliban to pin them down while coalition forces maneuver. The A-10 is a master at that.
Boy, when I've seen film of the A-10 and that 30 millimeter Gatling gun in the nose, wow! I would not at all want to be on the receiving end. That, I don't know of any other aircraft that really can do that in this day. And it is so, how should I say, powerful and so much a part of our deterrent. So the future will be that we're not going to be losing the A-10 anytime soon. Is that correct?
No, there will be, I think they're going to trim the A-10 force a little bit. You know, we just had a big round of budget cuts come out a couple weeks ago, and I think they will retire a few of the A-10s, but the weapon system as a whole is due to stay around. They, in fact, have taken some steps to expand the life and to bring it up so that it can put more hours on the A-10 by strengthening the structure. So they plan to keep A-10s in the force.
The program that I saw regarding the A-10, that the pilots had at one point, this one pilot had three missions in 4 hours. He was in the cockpit. He hot fueled meaning he did not get out of the cockpit. From what I understand, he didn't even shut the engines off, and he was back out there again. Wow, what durability. They actually had to pull the pilot, the service people, the techs, had to pull the guy out at the end of the day. So that says a lot, though, for the pilots to feel that way about their aircraft and to feel that way about flying something that still is stick and rudder. You still got to fly the darn thing. Speaking of, and I did not know that this was still part of the Air Force. I thought they'd retire it. What about the U-2 spy plane?
U-2. So there's an aircraft that's a real contemporary of the B-52 in design. Such a famous plane, designed in the mid-1950s to be a super high altitude aircraft that could fly over the Soviet Union in secret and take pictures of the developing missile and bomber force. Remember, this was right after the Soviet Union had tested its first atomic and then hydrogen bombs, and we were desperate to know what they might have in that country. Totalitarian state. So the U-2 was developed to be able to fly over the Soviet Union. And very famously, one was shot down in 1960 by a surface-to-air missile. The U-2s today are the same plane in spirit. They are a little bit newer, and they have some significant redesign that was done in the 60s. But they're still an old plane. They're still manned. They're very light. They fly at super high altitudes. The pilots have to wear specialized suits. But what they do now is their mission is to collect all sorts of intelligence. They take pictures that can be electro-optical, which is what you think of like TV. It could be infrared, which is looking for hot spots. It can be synthetic aperture radar, where a series of radar shots work at longer range to form a really good image of maybe an enemy missile site or something like that. And they also scoop up what's referred to as signals intelligence. So they listen to what the enemy is broadcasting and what its weapons are saying. The U-2s have been pretty busy on, you know, when there are tensions in Korea, you'll find the U-2s flying. They fly missions in Europe as well, and they fly missions around the Middle East. But the astonishing thing is the Air Force had for some years planned to retire the U-2 because in the end it's a great plane, but it's limited by the endurance of the pilot. Then just a few weeks ago, the Air Force reversed its position and said that in fact they will keep the U-2. And they're going to retire a much newer system called the Global Hawk, which is an unmanned high-altitude drone aircraft. They're not retiring all of them, but they're retiring about a big portion of the fleet. It was really a shock here in Washington to hear that the U-2 would stay and the much newer Global Hawk would have some retirements.
You know, that's interesting because everybody's talking about unmanned this and unmanned that, and you know what? They still need somebody to fly the darn thing. And here they are. They're finding out that the pilots are still needed. Now, one of the things that happened when the U-2 was shot down, that, well, what have they, are they flying the U-2 higher up in the atmosphere to keep that away, or is it still vulnerable to surface-to-air missiles?
Well, the U-2, and in fact, just about every aircraft we fly is vulnerable to surface-to-air missiles. Like I said, this happened back in 1960, and it showed that surface-to-air missiles were now capable of targeting higher-altitude aircraft under certain conditions. So the shootdown of the U-2 is, in fact, you know, really a chapter in history for many reasons, but partly because it led us to start developing a technology known as stealth. And stealth didn't come to fruition for many, many years afterwards, really not until the early 1980s. But stealth was devised so that it could evade radar detection by these surface-to-air missiles, like the one that had shot down the U-2. And so it's from that that we see stealth becoming a huge piece of our top combat aircraft.
Well, that's a great segue into our next aircraft. But before we do that, we have a caller, Rod, from Colorado, another beautiful state. Oh, yeah, skiing in Colorado. How's the snow out there, Rod?
It's still there, Bob. It's still there. You want some?
No. I mean, yeah, it's okay for snow, but I'm waiting for spring, and it's going to happen here. I'm sure it's very beautiful in Colorado.
Right? I say June or July, Bob.
Okay, I'll remember that and book my I'll book my reservations. Rod, you have a question for Dr. Grant. Go ahead.
Yeah, first thing I want to say is, do I have Dr. Grant correct? Didn't I see you quite a bit on the military channel?
Yes, that was me.
Okay, well, I want to say I appreciated your information and certainly recognize your expertise because you really came across very professionally and very knowledgeable on that program. So I enjoyed seeing you there. Hope to see you again there sometime soon.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome. My question has to do with, when we're talking about Air Force defensive strategy, I always think of as a good defense is a good offense. Is the Air Force going to be taking any responsibility as far as EMP weaponry goes, either defensively or offensively in the next decade?
Well, Rod, that's a great question. You're asking about EMP, which stands for electromagnetic pulse. And
right.
That's something that can happen in a bunch of different ways. And, in fact, lightning is a problem there as well. You'll be glad to know, and you may already, of course, that aircraft are what they call EMP hardened. So take an aircraft like the B-2 stealth bomber. It's built so that its skin surface and its flight controls and the cockpit glass, and most importantly, its electronics can withstand EMP radiation, for example, from an enemy nuclear weapon or from another big high-pulse source. So EMP hardening is still certainly a part of aircraft design. You're also asking a little bit about EMP weapons, and let me just turn that to talk for a minute about directed energy weapons, and we think of that most commonly as a laser. I expect that we will see laser weapons within the next couple of decades. The Air Force developed a system you may be familiar with called the airborne laser. It was a liquid chemical laser. Boeing was the main contractor, built for a wide-body jet and able to use a laser to shoot down missiles in flight. They worked a long time on the system and made some great strides. It was canceled recently because it just wasn't quite where they wanted it to be, and there were some budget issues, too. But the thing that we want to move to is to look at a solid-state laser for airborne applications. The problem now is that they're at low power, but I think the science tells us that we'll see higher power output from those solid-state lasers in the future. And so, Bob, if you and I are doing this show 20 years from now, Rod can ask us about how we think these laser weapons are working on an aircraft of the future. So I certainly see that, not in the short term, but in the medium to longer term.
Rod, does that answer your question?
Yes, it sounds good. And, Doctor, thank you very much. I guess I'm more confident now with the rise of Chinese weaponry that the Air Force and their Department of Defense is well aware of what's going on there, and it's got some plans to counteract anything that the Chinese can throw at us. So, Dr. Grant, I wish you continued success and hope to see you back on Military Channel real soon.
Great. Thank you so much for your call. Great.
Thank you for being on the air with us, Rod.
Sure, Bob. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, there you go, folks. Now, if you have a question for Dr. Grant or a comment, why don't you give us a call? It's toll-free. Don't cost you nothing. That's right. Not too many things today that are gratis, that are no cost. And you can give us a call at 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. We're now going to get into stealth. How did that come about, the whole technology, finding out about that? Was that something that we copied something, or a facsimile of something that we copied, or was it strictly developed by the United States engineers? Dr. Grant?
I am going to call that as strictly a U.S. invention and one of our very best. Certainly there were some scientific principles and things that we learned from long research on the electromagnetic spectrum, but stealth is something we invented here in the U.S. It grew out of early research on missile nose cones, And by the early 60s, there were some bright radar engineers who said, wow, when that shape is smooth, like the front cone of a missile, I can hardly see it on my radar. And from that came the idea of building an aircraft that used those smooth and radar controlling technologies. Much easier said than done. And a key breakthrough came when an engineer named Dennis Overholser, who worked for the Lockheed Aircraft Company out in Burbank, California, read a paper that had been written by a Russian, interestingly enough. But Dennis Overholser's insight was, he said, hey, if we made an airplane that used facets, diamond shapes on the outside, we could add up all the angles, figure out where the radar energy was going, and instead of sending that radar energy back to the enemy radar, we could send it off and scatter it into space. And that became the genesis of the F-117 stealth fighter. That breakthrough, a really American invention.
Now, is there something else in the coating, in the paint, that's also radar absorption?
Absolutely, Bob. That's quite right. So the idea was, with the radar, the energy goes out. It hits a big target like a B-52, and it's metal, and it bounces right back and tells you where the aircraft is and where it's heading. It gives you, you know, altitude and azimuth. The idea of stealth was partly to use the shape of the plane to send the radar waves off in a different direction. But to help with some of that, they had to develop radar-absorbing material called RAM, so that some of the radar waves would sink in to the skin of the aircraft and, again, not get returned back and give an accurate position on the aircraft. RAM was especially important early on, and the engineers say that you get most of your stealth results from the shape, about two-thirds or three-quarters, and the rest comes from the radar-absorbing materials. Luckily, those have come a long way, but the key breakthrough was the development of the F-117. It was developed in great secrecy in the late 1970s, and then the Air Force produced 59 F-117 aircraft. They were built quite quickly in the early 1980s and, of course, made their great public debut in the Gulf War of 1991, where they were responsible for, they flew over a very heavily defended areas in Iraq and in Baghdad by themselves and dropped bombs on key targets and took out probably about 40% of the fixed strategic targets, while flying only about 2% of the total aircraft sorties in Operation Desert Storm.
Wow.
So, great.
Wow. I have to stop you. We're coming up on a break. Take a break yourself, because I know you've done a lot of talking. We'll be right back. Veterans Radio.
Lieutenant Robert Nett was seriously wounded during hand-to-hand combat, but continued to lead his men. Details after this. Nett commanded Company E in an attack against a reinforced enemy battalion that had held up the American advance for 2 days from its entrenched positions around a three-story concrete building. With another infantry company and armored vehicles, Company E advanced against heavy machine gun and other automatic weapons fire, with Nett spearheading the assault against the strong point. During the fierce hand-to-hand encounter that ensued, he killed 7 deeply entrenched Japanese with his rifle and bayonet, and, although seriously wounded, continued to lead his men forward, refusing to relinquish his command. Again, he was severely wounded, but still unwilling to retire, pressed ahead with his troops to assure the capture of the objective. Wounded once more in the final assault, he calmly made all arrangements for the resumption of the advance, turned over his command to another officer, and then walked unaided to the rear for medical treatment. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
There we go. We're back right now, Veterans Radio, and we're talking with Dr. Rebecca Grant. Dr. Grant is president of IRIS, Independent Research, a public policy research organization located in Washington, D.C. She's also an active member of the Air Force Association. Dr. Grant, I hope you had a cup of coffee during that break.
I sure did.
Yes, you did. You really covered a lot of ground. By the way, folks, if you have a question for Dr. Grant or a comment, You want to know more about the defense of the Air Force for the next decade or just about any Air Force question, you want to call us at 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. Dr. Grant, we were talking about energy, radar-absorbing material, paint. We were talking about stealth. Now, when I was down in Dayton for the Dayton, Ohio Air Show about 3 years ago, I heard that the F-22 Raptor, the Joint Strike Fighter, was going to be the last manned fighter, the last one, after all that history, T-47s, and the F-16, etc., that the F-22 was going to be the last manned fighter. How is that all shaping up, Dr. Grant?
Well, we're actually going to have, for sure, the F-35. So we've been talking about stealth, and our two new stealth fighters are the F-22. Did you see one there in the museum in Dayton when you visited?
No, I did not. No, they were just going to get that when I was down there.
That's right. They have one now that was actually used in the test program, and they flew it so hard that they decided it probably wasn't safe to fly anymore. It seemed to be perfectly fine, but it pulled more G's, or gravitational forces, than they'd ever seen pulled in a fighter. And so when the test program was completed, this one went off to the museum in Dayton. Two new stealth fighters. F-22 is ending production in May. The Air Force has acquired 183 of those. The big new program that's going through production now, just beginning to ramp up, is the F-35, and it's the Joint Strike Fighter. I want to talk about both of those, if that's okay with you, Bob, because they're two pretty interesting stories.
Oh, fire away, Dr. Grant.
Well, let's start back with F-22. We had been talking about the F-117, and Bob, I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of that, but that was a pretty funny-looking jet. It had the nickname the Cockroach, and people looked at it and said, oh, it'll never fly. Well, of course it did, and it was a super aircraft, and they're now retired. But the F-22 was planned to take all the great advantages of a fighter. Supersonic speed, flying faster than the speed of sound, extreme maneuverability, the ability to pull 9Gs, and put that together with stealth. So it required some huge technology breakthroughs. And it looks real different. If you look at the F-22, which I had the great privilege to do last week out in Hawaii, the Hawaii Air National Guard has several F-22s, and they're building up to a full squadron. I got to walk around and look at theirs. It's very sleek. All of its surfaces are designed for stealth, but in the back are two extremely powerful Pratt & Whitney engines, and these engines just make this the best fighter ever designed or flown. And pilots say it almost flies itself. It's really different from the A-10. We were talking about the A-10 earlier, Bob, and how it's really a stick and rudder aircraft. Of course, there are still those features in the F-22, but the computer integration with the F-22 is just superb. So it is our high-end stealth fighter. It's better than anything else in the entire world. I'm not boasting. This is just fact. It can go faster than the speed of sound without using afterburner. Do you know what afterburner is, Bob?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, it's when, and you see it, you know, you see it a lot, like when a carrier aircraft takes off and you see that big flame, you know, the flare coming out the back, that gives it that speed for takeoff. Well, the F-22 can go faster than the speed of sound without using that, which is tremendous in fuel efficiency and also in helping it stay stealthier. It's extremely maneuverable, so it is really the top end. It's there in case we need to win air superiority against a peer competitor, a country like China with a big air force. If we need to gain control of the skies in that situation, we're going to need the F-22 for the future. The program, the other one I want to talk about, of course, is the F-35. And it is the reason that F-22 is not the last manned fighter. So seeing the success of the 117 and also of the F-22, the decision was made by the Navy and the Air Force and the Marine Corps and Britain's Royal Air Force to get together on a stealth fighter program. They started this research back in the 90s, and the result is Lockheed Martin's F-35, and there are three types of F-35s. They're very similar, not exactly alike, but they're very similar. There's the F-35A, and that's regular runway takeoff. The Air Force is buying that version, as are several of our top allies, scheduled to buy it as well. Then there is, bear with me here, there is the F-35B, and that is the Marine Corps version. It was actually one of the first ones to go into test, and so the Marines are pretty far down the road in having that capability developed and ready to go. The unique thing about F-35B is it can take off vertically. So it's what they call STOVL, long acronym, stands for short takeoff and vertical landing. So that's, do you know the Harrier, the Aviate Harrier that goes up and down?
Yes.
The F-35B is the replacement for the Harrier.
Okay. Now that was British, right, the Harrier?
That's right. The Harrier was a British design. Fabulous aircraft, really tricky to fly. And there's some real combat losses from the Harriers. But the Marine Corps bought them so that they could do expeditionary operations and so they can operate off amphibious ships, which to you and me, Bob, would look like smaller aircraft carriers. They wouldn't to a Navy man or woman, but to us they look like small aircraft carriers. So that's the F-35B, and the Marine Corps will be buying that variant. They are completely committed to it as being part of their aviation modernization. They've waited and put off purchases of other aircraft they might have bought in order to get F-35B.
Wow,
that's not it. There's a third variant as well, which I can tell you about.
Oh, yes, go ahead, please.
Okay, so remember I said the other big partner here was the United States Navy. And, of course, they do carrier operations, big deck carriers. When I was in Hawaii last week, I was at Pearl Harbor, Joint Base Pearl Harbor, it's called now, together with Hickam Airfield, both so historic. And I happened to be driving right along the channel when an aircraft carrier came in. It was the USS Stennis coming back from a long deployment. And it just was so moving to see all the sailors in their whites lined up along the flight deck returning from several months out in Central Command and out in the Pacific. So future for naval aviation, F-35C, or Charlie, the C variant. It looks a lot like the other two, but its wing area is a little bit bigger. And, of course, it's been made more rugged so that it can take the stress of carrier landings. And it has a tailhook, still the system that naval aviators use to catch a wire stretched across the flight deck. And that's what slows them down and brings them to a stop on the deck. So,
and you got to have a pilot to do that, folks.
Pilots, we think about unmanned planes, and they are great. We think about Predator or the Reaper, which is a slightly heavier version of Predator. But, you know, the aircraft weight of those is very light. A Predator weighs about 2,000 pounds versus a B-52, which weighs so much more. Even when you look at a fighter like an F-15, empty weight of an F-15 is, you know, 40,000 pounds. So in a light aircraft like Predator, which is used for reconnaissance, it's really nice not to have to put the weight of a pilot in. In a bigger aircraft that's carrying a lot of fuel and weapons and bombs, the weight of the pilot isn't as important anymore. And what is important is the brains of that pilot and their ability to get the mission done. So that's why pilots are still pretty important to these aircraft.
Now, if you want to know more about this, my listeners out there to Veterans Radio, Dr. Grant wrote a paper on that. Dr. Grant, why don't you tell us very quickly, we've got about a minute before the next break, how can they read your paper? What do they have to do?
Sure. This paper in particular is the case for a new stealth bomber, and it's available at the website www.irisresearch.com, I-R-I-S research, and you'll find it under the blog called All Things Pentagon, case for the new stealth bomber.
Okay, folks, You've heard it right here. We're going to go to our next break, our last break in the program. If you have a question for Dr. Grant, give us a call at 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. When we come back with Dr. Grant, we're going to talk about air power in the Pacific. We talked a little bit about China, and I know at the last program she mentioned that on China. So you're going to stick around here and get all that information. We'll be right back. Yeah, there it is, the Air Force song. Off we go into the wild blue yonder. We've got our last segment here at Veterans Radio. If you have a question for Dr. Grant regarding Air Force power in the next decade, call us toll-free at 877-573-7825. 877-573-7825. Our operators are standing by to take your call. All the lines are open at 877-573-7825. Also, I want to get in that today's program, of course, the Marine Scholars Program at Ave Maria University. Getting back with Dr. Grant. Last time you were on the program, you talked about China. We didn't get into that as much as I would have liked to. Now, we're not. They're not enemies, whatever, folks. This is not it. But we don't ever want to get our knickers down like we did over at Pearl Harbor. So we have to be prepared for that. And right now, I'd like Dr. Grant to talk about air power in the Pacific, which I'm sure will include China. Dr. Grant, take over.
Absolutely. So here's a key event of 2012, and that was the January release of a new strategy affecting, you know, and it's called Sustaining U.S. Global Leadership Priorities for 21st Century Defense, released by the White House. And it specifically says that we need, of course, to continue with the counterterrorism work that we're doing, that we've been doing for 10 years, but that our focus for the future is increasingly on Asia. And there are two pieces to this. One, quite frankly, is countering the rise of Chinese military power, which has gone up a lot over the last 15 years. And the second piece, intertwined, is strengthening our relationships with our many partners and allies in the region. That starts with allies like Japan, Australia, and moves right on through to nations that are allies and partners. And, you know, that Pacific theater is really all about doing that. There's another piece of it, too, I want to mention right up front, and that is responding to natural disasters. It's been just about a year since the tsunami and nuclear disasters in Japan, and we carried out what is called Operation Tomodachi. There was assistance from the Navy and from the Air Force in that, and our Air Force commander in the Pacific, who is a four-star general named Gary North, he likes to say that Mother Nature can rear her head more quickly than any enemy and often cause more devastation. So part of our military power there is to be able to respond to disasters and in so doing help to build up our relationships with those in the region. But the other big piece of this, frankly, is getting us into a posture where we can effectively deter the rise of Chinese military power. We know China is an economic powerhouse, but they've matched that in the last 15 years with great improvements in their Navy, in their air forces, in their cyberspace capabilities. They knocked a satellite out of orbit back in 2007. It was one of their own, but it was widely seen as a demonstration of their extremely sophisticated capabilities. We know they have plans for activities related to the moon, and certainly they are asserting their dominance in the Pacific. What we want to do there, I think, as a nation is balance that. I foresee decades of us maintaining military power that matches, and that frankly that overmatches China's, so that there's no question about China being able to expand its influence beyond where we and our allies would like it to go. So to do that, just think of the map of Asia. It is such a huge region. That is really an air power theater. Naval force is very important as well. But as we look at deterring potential Chinese missile threats or aircraft, it really comes down to our bombers, our fighters, our satellites, and our command and control network. and most of all our deployable air power to be able to maintain U.S. interests out in the Pacific region.
Now, you talk about an air-sea battle, a five-year effort by the Air Force. Why don't you talk a little, and the Navy, to share the tactics. Talk a little bit more about that. Have you covered that, or do you have something else you could add?
Oh, well, let me add. That's a great question, Bob. Air-sea battle, big effort by the Navy and the Air Force. And everybody knows it's not always easy for two services to get together and really seriously work on this. I give a lot of credit to the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Gary Ruffhead, who just retired. Admiral Jonathan Greenert has continued that, the new CNO, and to Air Force Chief of Staff Norton Schwartz. They have gotten together themselves. They've gotten their staff together. And the whole point is to say, all right, Navy, what do you have out in the Pacific? And Air Force, what do you have in planes, in weapons, in command and control, in maintaining missile warning, in cyberspace and the connectivity? So they are working very hard to make sure that they can share their budget responsibilities and come up with the concept that ensures that China can't steal one over on us out in the Pacific. So air-sea battle, very big, very real initiative, really shows the need to cooperate. There are a lot of logistical challenges in the Pacific, moving around people, planes, fuel, etc., and it's going to take full cooperation from the Air Force and the Navy. The fact that the head of those two services are working closely together should tell us all how seriously they take this problem.
Now, this is great, because they call this a segue in the radio business. You talked about fuel. These weapons have to be refueled, and you've got here on your little email that you sent to me about a new tanker being developed, the KC-46. It's designed by Boeing. Tell us about that.
Oh, this is what makes air power global. It's the ability to refuel in the air. And the current fleet is pretty old. KC-135 tankers, they're the same age as those B-52s and U-2s we talked about earlier. So just a year ago, Boeing won the contract after lots of delays and questions. Everyone in Washington was really glad to see this move forward, because Boeing is now getting right into the detailed design work on the new KC-46. It'll take a 767 airliner, which you've probably flown in lots of times, and convert that to carry fuel and also to carry some cargo and passengers and do medical evacuation. But the main purpose of this tanker is to provide fuel in the air to our reconnaissance and our combat aircraft. You just can't fly a bomber or especially a fighter out in the Pacific without that air refueling available. They'll need it if they're going into a strike mission. They need it right before the strike. They really need it right after the strike. And it's air refueling that gives us that global power. Absolutely essential, and great to see that program going forward so that we can keep that reach out in the Pacific.
Now, of course, it is. You're running out of fuel. You got to find yourself a way back. That I'm trying to picture this C-46. How much larger is it in the KC-135?
It is quite a bit bigger, because the KC-135 is built off a 707, a little narrow body, very elegant, very efficient aircraft. But the KC-46 will carry quite a bit more fuel, and you're really going to need that on the Pacific, where every aircraft needs the fuel. But the tanker itself will be air refuelable. Our current tankers aren't, except for a handful. These tankers, so if one tanker is ready to go off station, it can take the rest of its fuel and put it into a tanker that's staying on station. And if you believe it, those were some lessons that were learned on long missions in Afghanistan. There are some missions up there where it's wintertime and the weather's terrible, and aircraft are several hundred miles from their bases, and they absolutely have to have fuel to get back safely, to get back at all. And so they would actually try to, they need to transfer fuel from tanker to tanker. They also refuel some of the big planes, like the AWACS, which is an airborne radar surveillance plane. Basically, every combat aircraft out there needs fuel, and it's not just Air Force planes. The Navy relies on big Air Force tankers. Our allies rely on them as well. So they are absolutely essential. We just don't have the ability to strike and deter and hold targets at risk without a tanker. Tanker has to go forward, and it is.
Thank you, Dr. Grant. I do have another listener gave us a call. That's Fred from Flint, and he has a question for Dr. Grant regarding certain models of planes and recent missile launch. We've got about 2.5 minutes. Fred, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Good morning. Semper Fi.
Semper Fi.
Wondering, wondering if you could tell the audience whatever happened to the YF-22 fighter jet, and also the componentry various jets. I have learned much of it is foreign made, including communist China. And last question, there was a missile launch last year, I believe it was, last summer maybe, that was supposedly a visual mirage, you know, tongue-in-cheek joke. But eyewitnesses said it was a missile launch off the California coast.
Dr. Grant?
Fred, absolutely. Let me take that last one first. I remember...
We only have a minute and a half, so we got to do this quick.
Okay. I read the reports like you did on the TV stuff on the L.A. missile, whatever it was. I don't know anything more than you do. So let me get into YF-22. YF-22 was the technology demonstrator that won the competition for Lockheed, and it became the F-22. There were some changes made to it, but it became the F-22, so that's what happened with it. Fred, you asked, are there foreign-made components in U.S. aircraft like some of the fighters? And the answer in some cases is yes, but remember the program managers tightly control and are not allowed to use foreign components in some key technology areas. So rest assured that they watch that pretty closely and know very well and do the really sensitive stuff. That is all done with U.S. sourcing.
Well,
I sure hope so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Fred from Flint. Boy, what an exciting program, and we've come to the end again. Dr. Grant, would you please come back on the program?
I certainly will, Bob. I love Veterans Radio, and I enjoy talking to the listeners today.
Well, thank you very much, and if you want to know more from Dr. Grant, you want to go to www.irisresearch.com. irisresearch.com. Dr. Grant, you have yourself a blessed day. And we'll talk to you soon. You're listening to Veterans Radio. You are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.